Welcome to Astounding Stories of Space and Time. I'm Mardell, reading The Skylark of Space by E.E. Smith. Chapter 3. Seton's childhood had been spent in the mountains of northern Idaho, a region not much out of the pioneer stage, and offering few inducements to intellectual effort. He could only dimly remember his mother, a sweet, gentle woman with a great love for books, but his father, Big Fred Seton, a man of but one love, almost filled the vacant place. Fred owned a quarter section of virgin white pine timber, and in that splendid grove he established a home for himself and his motherless boy. In front of the cabin lay a level strip, or meadow, beyond which rose a magnificent snow-crowned peak that caught the earliest rays of the sun. This mountain, dominating the entire countryside, was to the boy a challenge, a question, and a secret. He accepted the challenge, scaling its steep sides, hunting its forests and fishing its streams. He toughened his sturdy young body by days and nights upon its slopes. He puzzled over the question of its origin as he lay upon the needles under some monster pine. He put staggering questions to his father, and when in books he found some partial answers, his joy was complete. He discovered some of the mountain secrets then, some of the laws that govern the world of matter, some of the beginnings man's mind has made toward understanding the hidden mechanism of nature's great simplicity. Each taste of knowledge whetted his appetite for more. Books, books! More and more he devoured them, finding in them meat for the hunger that filled him and answers to the questions that haunted him. After Big Fred lost his life in the forest fire that destroyed his property, Seton turned his back upon the woods forever. He worked his way through high school and won a scholarship at college. Study was a pleasure to his keen mind, and he had ample time for athletics, for which his backwoods life had fitted him outstandingly. He went out for everything and excelled in football and tennis. In spite of the fact that he had to work his way, he was popular with his college mates, and his popularity was not lessened by an almost professional knowledge of sleight of hand. His long, strong fingers could move faster than the eye could follow, and many a lively college party watched in vain to see how he did what he did. After graduating with highest honors as a physical chemist, he was appointed research fellow in a great university, where he won his Ph.D. by brilliant research upon rare metals, his dissertation having the lively title of Some Observations Upon Certain Properties of Certain Metals, Including Certain Transuranic Elements. Soon afterward, he had his own room in the Rare Metals Laboratory in Washington, D.C. He was a striking figure, well over 6 feet in height, broad-shouldered, narrow-waisted, a man of tremendous physical strength. He did not let himself grow soft in his laboratory job, but kept in hard, fine condition. He spent most of his spare time playing tennis, swimming, and motorcycling. As a tennis player, he quickly became well known in Washington's sporting and social circles. During the district tournament, he met M. Reynolds Crane, known to only a few intimates as Martin. The multimillionaire explorer, archaeologist, sportsman, who was then district singles champion, Seton had cleared the lower half of the list and played Crane in the final round. Crane succeeded in retaining his title, but only after 5 of the most grueling, bitterly contested sets ever seen in Washington. Impressed by Seton's powerful slashing game, Crane suggested that they train together as a doubles team. Seton accepted instantly, and the combination was highly effective. Practicing together almost daily, each came to know the other as a man of his own kind, and a real friendship grew up between them. When the Crane Seton team had won the district championship and had gone to the semi-finals of the national before losing, the two were upon a footing which most brothers could have envied. Their friendship was such that neither Crane's immense wealth and high social standing, nor Seton's comparative poverty and lack of standing, offered any obstacle whatever. Their comradeship was the same, whether they were in Seton's modest room or in Crane's palatial yacht. Crane had never known the lack of anything that money could buy. He had inherited his fortune and had little or nothing to do with its management, preferring to delegate that job to financial specialists. However, he was in no sense an idle rich man with no purpose in life. As well as being an explorer and an archaeologist and a sportsman, he was also an engineer, a good one, and a rocket instrument man, second to none in the world. The old Crane estate in Chevy Chase was now, of course, Martin's, and he had left it pretty much as it was. He had, however, altered one room, the library, and it was now peculiarly typical of the man. It was a large room, very long, with many windows. At one end was a huge fireplace, before which Crane often sat, with his long legs outstretched, studying one or several books from the cases close at hand. The essential furnishings were of a rigid simplicity, but the treasures he had gathered transformed the room into a veritable museum. He played no instrument, but in a corner stood a magnificent piano, bare of any ornament, and a Stradivarius reposed in a special cabinet. Few people were asked to play either of those instruments, but to those few Crane listened in silence, and his brief words of thanks showed his real appreciation of music. He made few friends, not because he hoarded his friendship, but because, even more than most rich men, he had been forced to erect around his real self an almost impenetrable screen. As for women, Crane frankly avoided them, partly because his greatest interests in life were things in which women had neither interest nor place, but mostly because he had for years been the prime target of the man-hunting debutantes and the matchmaking mothers of three continents. Dorothy Vanneman, with whom he had become acquainted through his friendship with Seton, had been admitted to his friendship. Her frank comradeship was a continuing revelation, and it was she who had last played for him. She and Seton had been caught near his home by a sudden shower and had dashed in for shelter. While the rain beat outside, Crane had suggested that she pass the time by playing his fiddle. Dorothy, a doctor of music and an accomplished violinist, realized with the first sweep of the bow that she was playing an instrument such as she had only known in her dreams, and promptly forgot everything else. She forgot the rain, the listeners, the time and the place. She simply poured into that wonderful violin everything she had of beauty, of tenderness, of artistry. Sure, true, and full tones filled the big room, and in Crane's vision there rose a home filled with happy work, with laughter and companionship. Sensing the girl's dreams as the music filled his ears, he realized as never before in his busy and purposeful life what a home with the right woman could be like. No thought of love for Dorothy entered his mind. He knew that the love existing between her and Dick was of the sort that only death could alter. But he knew that she had unwittingly given him a great gift. Often thereafter, in his lonely hours, he saw that dream home and knew that nothing less than its realization would ever satisfy him. Please join me next time for more adventure in The Skylark of Space by E.E. Smith, here on Astounding Stories of Space and Time. Until then, watch the skies. Thank you.